Our first reading is from Matthew 26. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they didn't find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, "This fellow said, 'I'm going to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God." "You have said so," Jesus replied. "But I say to all of you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" "He is worthy of death," they answered. And then they spat in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, Messiah. Who hit you?" And from Luke 23. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Messiah, a king." So Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "You have said so," Jesus replied. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests and to the crowd, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." But they insisted, "He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here." On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased because for a long time he'd been wanting to see him. From what he'd heard about him, he hoped to see him perform a sign of some sort. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there, vehemently accusing him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed him and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they'd been enemies. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him." But the whole crowd shouted, "Away with this man! Release Barabbas to us!" Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again, but they kept shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" For the third time he spoke to them, "Why? What crime has this man committed? I have found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him punished and then release him." But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So, Pilate decided to grant that demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they'd asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. This is the word of the Lord.
So I have a confession. I struggled to prepare for this week's message. And normally, if you've been around, you know that I'd start with a story or an illustration to help you connect with the theme, right? But I couldn't just find one to tell. It's not because there weren't any stories. There were actually too many. Because every morning as I flipped through my newspaper over breakfast, I was overwhelmed by examples of what I think are pretty clear injustices. Which one do I pick? Government overreach into personal decisions. Billionaires trying to buy Supreme Court elections. I mean, that seems like old news now. Like, that was only like 6 days ago, I think, right? Legal immigrants snatched off the streets and deported off to El Salvador. Families upended by government cuts. Medicaid reductions disproportionately affecting low income, and especially in DC, that is predominantly African American families. Insurrectionists pardoned, and some even celebrated as heroes. Lies spread for political gain. And through it all, those without power or resources bear the weight of these injustices. So today, it's a choose your own opening illustration moment. Pick your fist-shaking issue, whether it's public or whether it's private, and let that simmer in your hearts for a bit. Bring that to mind. And if you've got it coming to mind, something that, kids, I know you've said this before, who have said, "That's so unfair"? Yeah, okay. So if you've got a moment, shake your fist up for me and show me. Yeah. Grr. Okay, keep that in your mind as we're listening to the story today. You don't have to keep your hand up, though. All four Gospels record Jesus' encounters with the justice or injustice system of his day. Today's texts track over just a matter of hours. He's interrogated by the Jewish ruling council, by the Roman governor of Judea, and the ruler of Galilee. False accounts are made. His character is challenged. Each party twists the charges to serve their own agenda, ultimately trying to just disappear Jesus. Last week, we saw how Jesus, with all of his divine authority, all of his sovereign power, engaged with earthly power. And today, we're going to explore how that sense of divine sovereignty informs his response to unjust systems. Jesus knows injustice. He really does. And maybe, just maybe, we can learn from the righteous and just one as he faces the unjust powers of his time. So first off, here are some key players assisted by AI image generation. Now, we're pretty distant from the world of Jesus, and so this will help us orient to the characters because there's a lot of them. And so you'll see there's misspellings because of AI, and there's also like things that don't belong in the time, like eyeglasses, because eyeglasses weren't invented till the 14th century. But if it helps you connect, then helps you connect, right? Okay, there's first the chief priests. These were the leading priests dominated by a group called the Sadducees, and they were the ones who were responsible for the temple functions. So in modern day, think the cardinals of the Catholic Church. They kind of ran the ceremonies and governance of the temple at the time. Then you have the group called the Pharisees. They were a religious and political group known for very strict interpretation and enforcement of Jewish laws and traditions. In other words, they were the modern day religious fundamentalists and legalists. And then you have this group called the scribes. They're the Jewish legal experts who helped write legal documents and draft them and interpreted and taught the Torah. They're kind of like our modern day lawyers or constitutional experts. We might have some of those people here. No, you're not the scribes, but you do that kind of work. Then you have Pontius Pilate. Oh, no, then groups of those would be gathered into this group called the Sanhedrin, which is the highest ruling council in the religious and political realm for the Jewish community. So they had some Pharisees and some Sadducees and some chief priests to make up this group called the Sanhedrin. And at the top of that Sanhedrin was Caiaphas, who is the chief priest. And he kind of acted like the judge or the presiding presider of that council. And they were the highest legal and political and religious authority in the Jewish community. Now you have Pontius Pilate. He's the Roman governor responsible for keeping order and enforcing Roman law in the region. He handled taxes, he resolved conflict, and he had the final say in legal cases, especially executions, which is what was going on in the scene today. And then we have, lastly, Herod Antipas. There's a bunch of different Herods, but this is Herod Antipas. And he was the governor or the king over Judea and Galilee and Perea, but only had that power with Rome's authority. He had some local authority handling taxes and regional affairs, but he really couldn't make big decisions without Roman approval. And so his title of king was more about tradition than actual power. And so kids, if you're following along, your coloring sheets are actually following the story. So you can trace it along. And if you need one of those, raise your hand and one of the ushers can help get you a copy of those as well. So you have all these players in Jesus' encounter with the justice system of his time. So while our modern justice system is far from perfect, it generally ensures some level of accountability and protection for a defendant when procedures and precedent is followed, right? Now, for lawyers amongst us, or maybe you just really like law dramas like Law and Order, the scenes here with Jesus are full of procedural issues and false charges. So I'm going to walk through them pretty quickly here. So scene one, Jesus and religion with the Sanhedrin. So the Sanhedrin, the highest council of Jewish authority over religious and political matters, they question Jesus over kingship. And even though they don't believe him to be king, and by calling him and trying to associate him with the title Messiah or Son of God, they're trying to link him to a charge of insurrection, so that they can get him killed. But Jesus, so Jesus's trial itself, I want you to note, was illegal on many levels. First of all, it took place at night when those kinds of trials could only happen in the day. It also took place during a feast, the Passover, which shouldn't have happened according to Jewish tradition. It also happened in the home of the high priest rather than the official meeting place. It's kind of like doing a trial in one of the Supreme Court judges' homes rather than at the Supreme Court itself. It also didn't follow protocol of you must announce that, give advance notice before a trial was to take place. And also, you were supposed to give a full day after hearing the trial before you actually made a verdict. So, all of these procedural problems in this trial. But we don't see procedural problems in our day and age, right? So, in verses 59 and 60, the cross-examination of the witnesses is also deeply flawed. Jewish law required rigorous scrutiny of any witness, and especially if there were contradictions between them. And in capital cases, they wanted to kill him, execute him, false witnesses would themselves be put to death if they found out they were given false witness. But none of this happened. Even more, Caiaphas, the high priest, who is supposed to be the judge in this case, he violated legal tradition by asking Jesus to incriminate himself, and that is something that Jewish law did not permit. So the religious leaders finally charge him with blasphemy, a religious offense worthy of death. But they can't impose the death penalty. They have to rely on Pilate, the Roman governor. So when they bring him before Pilate, they change the charge. Procedural problems. Before Pilate, the accusation becomes not that Jesus claimed to be God, but Jesus claims to be king, and they present false evidence. And kids, you can see here this part, I think question 6 or 7, this is where it's happening in your worksheets. They accuse him of forbidding Jews to pay taxes to the emperor, despite just the day before, which we learned last week in last week's message, Jesus said, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's." This accusation is meant to challenge Caesar's sovereignty and to test Pilate's ability to prevent a potential uprising, especially during the Passover feast. In 23 verse 4 of Luke, Pilate sees right through the Sanhedrin's motives. He recognizes that the charge against Jesus is a religious one, not a political one or a legal one, and therefore he has no reason to act. Continuing on, verse 6, he seeks to avoid responsibility. How do I get out of this? He learns that Jesus, he's from Galilee. I'm going to send him over to Herod. I don't have to deal with this. Not my jurisdiction. Pass the buck. If Jesus was guilty under Herod's jurisdiction, then Pilate, he could wash his hands clean of it. So, no grounds for a death sentence in scene one. No grounds for a death sentence in scene two. And now we're in scene three, Jesus and his apparent king. We find that Herod is really just intrigued about Jesus' popularity because he sees him float up on his social media feed and people are talking about him. He wants to see Jesus do some miracles and do some special tricks. He's more interested in those things than actually hearing this case. Now Herod wanted to meet this supposed Messiah king. But when Jesus arrives before him, Herod is very unimpressed. He said, "This is my competition." He finds Jesus unworthy of his time and attention. Now, despite having Jesus and his accusers present before him, Herod didn't even see any reason to convict him. And it wasn't because Herod was above killing others. Because if you all know, Herod had already killed John the Baptist just because his wife didn't want John the Baptist around. And Herod had already said, in earlier Luke tells us in chapter 13, that Herod already wanted to kill Jesus. So here he has an opportunity. Yet he finds no grounds for the death sentence. So Jesus gets sent back to Pilate. And there, Pilate also again says for the third time, "I see no grounds for this." But Jesus gets sentenced to death only because the crowds ask for a death sentence, but being exonerated. They choose to exonerate a convicted insurrectionist and a murderer named Barabbas rather than the innocent Jesus. Jesus finds himself encountering injustice after injustice after injustice after injustice. What would you do if you were in his shoes? Caught in a system of a flawed justice system. I think most of us would instinctively at least deny the charges, right? Maybe we would file for dismissal. And maybe we would go on the counter-offensive and counter-sue for libel and go on the offensive publicly and social media and post all of our accusers and what they did and how unjust it was. After all, I would feel like that. I would feel, I have my rights. I demand justice. But what does Jesus do? In the first scene before the Sanhedrin, Jesus' response is striking. He simply remains silent. The high priest demands that he answer, but Jesus refuses. Instead of defending himself or denying the accusations, Jesus simply confirms the charge that placed on him. "You said this." He doesn't try to argue his innocence. Why? It's because Jesus is playing according to a different set of rules. He's playing a different game. He knows exactly who he is. His response is not just a confirmation, but it's a powerful declaration. He refers to himself as the Son of Man. This is a title that comes from Daniel 7. And Jesus positions himself not as a victim of their judgment, but as, in fact, their judge. And by saying, he says, "From now on, you will see the Son of Man." He's saying that the prophesied coming judge of the world that you all have been waiting for, that's not happening in the future. It's happening right now. It's right in front of you. Jesus is the Son of Man who now stands before them. And despite their accusations, it is they who will be judged by him and not the other way around. Jesus' silence in the other scenes before Pilate and Herod also reveal a profound truth. His power and his kingship are fundamentally different from the world's understanding of those things. See, where earthly rulers assert through authority and through force and through manipulation and domination and control, Jesus' authority is built on truth and real justice. His reign doesn't rely on military strength or political influence. And this becomes really clear when we look at his followers. They're poor, they're powerless, and they even abandon him at the first sight of trouble. They fail to fight for him in the conventional ways of wealth and weapons and guile. But this lack of earthly power highlights the radical difference of Jesus' kingdom, which doesn't depend on coercion, but on faithfulness to God. See, Pilate and Herod, while recognizing that this is really just a religious dispute between Jesus and these leaders, they show no interest in justice or resolution. Instead, they're just trying to get rid of him. They're unwilling to engage with the deeper challenges of him to their systems of power. In their eyes, Jesus is an inconvenience, but his silence speaks of a kingdom far greater than the ones that they rule. Jesus' silence before Herod and Pilate, even in the face of blatant injustice, foreshadows an ultimate victory. You see, in the book of Acts, which Luke also writes, he describes how the unjust actions of Herod and of Pilate will be turned over. Jesus will be worshipped as king. And while the powers of Rome and Israel seem to be dominating and have the upper hand in this situation, their sense of justice and power was actually very fragile. Jesus, on the other hand, was playing a different game of justice. Ultimately, Jesus' silence in the face of apparent injustice points to the paradox of the gospel. While we might instinctively want to defend ourselves and yell and retaliate, Jesus shows us a different path. His silence, his sovereign gentleness, his willingness to forgive, that speaks much louder than any words. And it comes out clearly with words when he's on the cross and he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." You see, Jesus plays a different game, one that challenges our conventional understanding of justice. In the face of apparent injustice, he shifts the focus away from defending individual rights to advocating for the flourishing and wholeness of all. It's the gospel paradox. See, this justice game isn't about protecting personal interests. It's about identifying with the marginalized and sacrificing for others in a way that reflects the heart of this gospel. It's a paradox. Ultimately, Jesus demonstrates this radical justice on the cross, where he bears the curse of sin upon himself so that everyone who turns to him can experience the fullness of God's love and forgiveness, which is true justice, which is making everything right. See, when Jesus invites his followers to take up the cross, he's calling us to consider the cost of living for the flourishing of others. That's another gospel paradox. This cross-shaped life isn't just a tattoo you put on your arm or a necklace you wear around your neck. The cross-shaped life is a way of living that actually actively seeks the good of all. This path of other-centered sacrifice is the one that we are called to follow. And crucially, this cruciform, this cross-shaped life, doesn't fight injustice on injustice's terms. Rather, it confronts injustice with love, exposing the flaws of worldly power through self-giving sacrifice. Cuban-American theologian Justo Gonzalez writes this: The gospel is not good news for those who thrive on injustice, whose power is oppressive and unjust. For them, the good news is first of all the possibility and the need of what may well be a costly repentance. See, the gospel confronts injustice, challenging the oppressor to repent either in this life or one day in the life to come. Now you might be thinking, well, playing a different game of justice seems like you're not asking us to do anything. But it doesn't mean as a Jesus follower that we don't engage in earthly justice systems. It doesn't mean that we don't speak out against injustices that we see in this world. It doesn't mean that we don't hold our leaders to account. We are called to do those things. The difference is that this justice game that we are invited to play as Jesus followers isn't about winning every single earthly conflict. It's about joining Jesus in this long game of that he is playing in creation, of renewing all things and restoring and reconciliation. This is the game that seeks this ultimate restoration of all of creation, which is the biblical understanding of justice, when God will make all things right. African-American theologian Dominique Gilliard says this in his book, Subversive Witness. Jesus, in his divine privilege, willingly endures injustice. In doing so, he identifies with the marginalized, standing in solidarity with those who have been oppressed and unjustly treated. Following Jesus is about going through with him rather than around. Following Jesus is about going through with him rather than around. See, following Jesus is about, if we look at his ministry, we see that Jesus passes through Samaria, a region of unwanted and marginalized people, at least for the Jews of his time, rather than go around it. And there we find that he commissions the first woman evangelist who brings the whole village into God's kingdom. A marginalized woman amongst a marginalized people who everyone would bypass, but Jesus passes through it and she becomes a key advocate for the entire village to come in to the flourishing life of God. Don't you think that is true justice? With Jesus, we too can enter into difficult neighborhoods, enter into troubled communities, not avoid them. We can step into conflict with others, and we're partnering with Jesus in his inbreaking work of the kingdom. That's already been at work in that space before you ever arrived. How much are we missing because we're not willing to go through it with Jesus? We're trying to go around it. One implication for us is that we may be fascinated by politics and all that's going on in the headlines, but we are invited to move from the political level to the personal level. We are called to go through with Jesus into the lives of others, even those that we might disagree with. It's a topic that the adult nurture class just covered 45 minutes ago or an hour ago. It might be easier for you to post political commentary on your social media that aligns with your views. It might be easier to cancel people from our lives because of disagreements, but Jesus calls us to move to do more than that. Don't get caught up in virtue signaling on social media. Don't spend your time constantly scrolling through news apps. Instead, go and serve someone in need. Bring justice there. Best-selling author David Brooks writes this, saying, "Politics offers a way to feel belonging by feeling properly enraged at the people you find contemptible. You don't have to be moral by actually serving the poor or sitting with the widow. Politics doesn't actually make you a better person or humanize you. It's about outer agitation rather than inner formation." I think we're all tempted to stay at this political level, to make us feel good about ourselves because of the common people that we don't like, rather than bringing justice to people who need it the most. go through with Jesus, not around. Let me share one final story. During our small group last week, one of our members shared how, in the midst of her anxiety of all that's going on in the world around us, in our city, she felt led to open up her home and invite people over on a regular basis. And when I commended her for her generosity and kindness, she said, "I'm not doing it for others, I'm doing it for myself." And we all laughed at her candor and her honesty. But what I heard in that moment was something very powerful. Even if she was doing it to help herself cope, she was actually living out a different kind of justice. By opening up her home, she was creating space for relationships to form, for community to grow that might not happen if she didn't do that. She wasn't simply building the kingdom of God by posting what she thought was true on social media. She was building for the kingdom in her home, despite her busy career and family life. And through that action, I think she probably expected Jesus to meet her in the midst of that. I know many of us are feeling overwhelmed by the injustices in the world today. Jesus knows your pain and anguish. It's what we voiced in the call to worship this morning. Jesus sees you in the midst of it. You are not alone. The Son of Man, the ruler of the entire universe, is with you. The righteous judge understands your struggles and walks through them with you. And for those of us burdened by injustice, Jesus invites us to respond with love, with compassion, and with service. Not fighting injustice with more injustice and domination and control, but with the transformative power of the kingdom that you belong to. Will you take action and step through with Jesus into those spaces and lives who need to hear it the most? And for those of us who are struggling with anger and confusion, Jesus calls you to step through with him. Don't avoid those tough places, or don't avoid those people who might disagree with you. Go where he's already at work, because he's already at work, serving and offering love to others. This is where transformation happens, not just in others, but in your own heart. And if you maybe feel far from God today, Jesus is inviting you to follow and trust him. Will you take up the cross with him? Not just as a symbol of your values, but as a way of life. His kingdom is one of grace and of kindness and of generosity, and he's inviting you into that. How might you respond today? Go through injustice with Jesus, offering justice and love and sacrifice in a world that desperately needs to see what it looks like. One life at a time. Be a part of that justice movement with Jesus. Amen.